CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
In this segment of our show, A. Laura Brody will be telling us a little bit about opulent mobility. So what can you tell me about opulent mobility?
Opulent mobility is something I started, the idea for it started in 2009, but the first show was in 2013, and mostly because I'd started putting together this type of artwork based on wheelchairs and walkers, and didn't have places to show them, not places that you could actually get them safely into. And I figured this was something that, if I was going to make art that had to do with that, it was important for people who were wheelchairs or users to be able to see it. So I started looking around for spaces, and because I'm a collaborative artist at heart, came from theater background, I wanted to have people join me and started inviting other people to reimagine disability.
So what was the inspiration behind this type of art for you?
The very first one was because a former partner, boyfriend, had a stroke, and I got a lot more intimately acquainted with adaptive devices. And I have really appreciated that they could be very helpful, and from an artist standpoint, they seemed almost insultingly ugly. I didn't figure that that needed to be that way. So I, many years later, asked a friend of mine who had a spare wheelchair if I could redo it into an Edwardian throne. And I did. And it was beautiful, and it was a total failure because I didn't understand enough about his needs as a quadriplegic about what his balance was, and had upholstered the back too thickly. So I realized, okay, I need to know so much more. I really need to research this. But also started looking into it that there were a lot of other designs for equipment that were beautiful that weren't going to market at all. This is probably around 2010 when I was starting to do that. And it just seemed like I had struck a nerve somewhere, that there was something that wasn't right, and I wanted to find out more about it. So I kept doing more research and making more art. Much later, I started recognizing that a lot of the disability things were more because it was relating to me with my own chronic illness and chemical sensitivities, not because I needed the equipment necessarily yet, but I felt that at any point I could, and I wanted to ask people who are users what they would want.
So what do you find is the benefit of having not only functional adaptations but aesthetically pleasing ones as well?
I think it's a human desire for most of the things that we have, right? If we only needed really basic things, there would only be one style of eyeglass. eyeglasses, right? There would only be one style of car. There would only be one style of phone. That's not what we do. That's not what human beings do. These are personal devices, and it seems strange to me that that wouldn't be taken into consideration. Almost any other vehicle, any other tool that we have, other considerations are made.
So how do you reach out to folks with disabilities to get their insights and to share your wisdom?
Well, I did it in multiple ways. When I first started doing this, I went to things like the Abilities Expo, which is a huge event that is all about disability and a lot about a disability equipment, and started asking people. I did surveys. I asked folks what they might want to have. And most of the people I came across hadn't really even thought about it, because at the time that just wasn't very common. It's become more common now. I also invited other people to reimagine disability with me because of that, and because I didn't specify that it would be about, say, the devices. I didn't specify what type of disability. I opened up an entire world of other people showing me what disability meant to them and what it could mean to celebrate it and to have it be opulent.
So I'm curious, and this might sound like a bit of an odd question, but do you think some of the aesthetic concerns were initially lost because the whole cost factor? A lot of adaptive devices are quite expensive, and people are more concerned with functionality, I would think.
Of course. Of course. I think that people always are. But people have always also decorated their own stuff. So that is a yes and to me. For an awful lot of the devices, they're more concerned, I think, frequently with medical liability, with insurance needs, and with cost, and not necessarily with function. You know, I know an awful lot of people who have devices that don't work that well for them, and that can be an extreme frustration. But once they get something that does work for them, wanting to make them personal really does become part of it as well.
So, in your time doing this work, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Interesting. I guess it's a yes and. I think it's a success in some ways each time I'm able to continue to do this. This grows a little bit every year, and that there are more people who want to become involved. One of the biggest ones stemmed from, frankly, things really not going well. Like a big success. The very first year that I did a larger exhibit was incredibly fortunate. A lot of things fell into my lap to do Ocular Mobility 2015 at Cal State Northridge. And then the next year, I could not get enough submissions of work that fit the theme at all. And because my own health was also starting to fade, I'm like, I'm going to have to call this up. And I wasn't sure if it was going to happen at all. So what seemed like it was going to be maybe, all right, maybe nobody else is interested. Maybe nobody cares. But it just didn't seem right. Like, okay, I just have to be much more specific with people about what needs to happen. And then was able to put on a smaller show the next year. And then after that, it started swelling, for lack of a better term. And more people started getting involved. I was able to get sponsorship. More people were reaching out to me from all over the world. So this has grown. The successes have been, sometimes they're smaller, right? But they keep growing. This year, actually, we're doing a retrospective over at the University of Southern California as part of Visions and Voices. And next year, there's going to be a really large retrospective of Southern California artists of ocular mobility at Grand Library. So each time, it grows a little bit more. And I'm starting to be able to get funding.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear from wheelchair fencer Trinity Lothian. So as an elite disability athlete yourself, what are your thoughts on the recent Paralympics?
As someone who was there, I think it was absolutely amazing, and I think they were such a success in Paris, like having the crowds there, and how we were like welcomed by the people and having all the volunteers there who were amazing. I obviously don't have any other games to compare it to, but it really felt like a success.
So what was the venue like? Did you find there were a lot of accessibility features where you were?
Yeah, for us, we were at the Grand Palais, and for me as a wheelchair user, it was 100% accessible. I had absolutely zero issues. I know for some people who could walk and had some more difficulties with that, there were some issues just because the venue was so big, and they would have to walk like so far just to get from one place to another. There were some issues with that just because it was so big and difficult to get from one place to the other. But for me, I didn't have any issues.
So what about actually getting there? That being quite a long flight, were there any accessibility matters that came up during the actual transit?
Yeah, for me, the transit on the way there, we had no issues. I'm from Ottawa, and so we drove to Montreal and flew out of Montreal just so that there would be less chances of, you know, bags going missing or anything like that. On the way back, my fencing chair did get damaged, and so it needs to go through some repairs, but it's quite an ideal time because I'm taking a break from fencing, so I don't need to use my chair for quite some time, so it's okay, I guess, that it got damaged, but I'm just glad that that didn't happen on the way there. But I think because the airlines and the airports were expecting, like, such a huge volume of para-athletes, there wasn't much of a concern compared to other times that I've traveled.
So what were some of the high points of the actual games?
For me, I think my two highlights, the first would have been the opening ceremonies, was just such a special moment for me where everything, I kind of realized that everything was coming true and that I was actually there, walking through Paris and seeing all the crowds. It was just a crazy, surreal moment for me. I definitely shed a few tears, and it was just so cool to be with so many other athletes. And then the other highlight for me was my first competition day in Sabre, which is not my event. I don't train in it whatsoever, so I went into it with no expectations other than to just have fun, and I had so much fun, and it was just so amazing to be on the huge stage with all of the audience and just have some fun fencing, and I enjoyed myself so much.
So for those who might have missed our prior interview, tell me a little bit about your journey to actually get to the Paralympics and how you became this great athlete.
So I didn't actually start fencing until a bit over 2 years ago, and I decided to start fencing once I became disabled. I thought that fencing would be a cool niche sport to get into that not many people in Canada did, so it seemed like a good opportunity to make the national team. And once I started fencing, alongside my coach at the Ottawa Fencing Club, we went to some competitions, and I ended up to start to get some good results, and we really decided that it was a path that clicked for me, and we kept going down the path, and in 2 years I qualified for the games, which was a pretty incredible accomplishment for me.
So, do you have any advice for young athletes out there who might be asking, does my disability keep me from achieving my goals, or is there still a road I can travel?
I think for anyone, regardless of their ability, like if sports is what interests you, go for it. There's ways to adapt really any sport to your body, and for me I found some sports kind of work better than others for my abilities, and I find that I have a lot more fun in sports that I can excel in and do better in. So to just keep trying things and to not kind of brush something aside just because it might not click right away. But there are other ways to do things, and to always reach out to others, because chances are you might not be the first one going down this path, and that there are others who have good advice for you too that you can reach out to.
So, that being said, I'd imagine that for any athlete with a disability to reach the elite level, there's some pretty intense training going on.
Yeah, it's definitely been a lot. In the lead up to the games, I was training like 6 times a week, a few sessions a day. And so now I'm definitely looking forward to taking a break and focusing on some other things other than sports.
Do you see yourself getting back into it and being a part of the next games?
Maybe, like, the next games in the summer is another 4 years away, and that's a really long time, and I don't know what my health will look like then and what other priorities I'll have in life. So for now, I'm really just appreciating the chance that I had in Paris and those memories, and I'm definitely not making any commitments yet to the games in L.A.
Like, thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Disability Studies Students Association is a small and tight-knit community of people who are passionate about and committed to representing and supporting disability studies students at the University of Windsor. The DSSA holds events on campus and in the community, like the annual Down Syndrome Day Walk, to raise funds for supporting organizations. If you would like to get involved or learn more, you can contact the Disability Studies Student Association directly at dssa@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard about opulent mobility from A. Laura Brody, and wheelchair fencer Trinity Lothian took us through a little bit of her Paralympic journey. In this segment of our show, Patty Chiappetta will be telling us a little bit about innovative life options. So what can you tell me about innovative life options?
We are a nonprofit organization. We've been, I'll just do some of those basic things, like we've been incorporated since the year 2000. We provide direction and support to people with an intellectual disability in the province of Manitoba. We have three kind of lines of business, or three areas that we focus on. Really our foundation and our really important one is the In Company of Friends model. It's a community living perspective, and then we have an options for services program, and then we have a community navigator. And the In Company of Friends is just very much supports people to live the best life that they can in the community. Most of the individuals that are in, I'm going to use the acronym ICOF, so most of the people that are in ICOF live on their own with support staff that might come in as much as needed. They have a support network around them to help them with decision making, with daily life kind of thing, and they really just, they create a life that they enjoy and that they want for themselves.
So I'm curious, how do you reach out to the disability community to let them know that these supports exist and might be available to them?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we are very much in the community. We participate and partner with lots of other disability organizations. Our very small main office is in a building that has four other organizations that reach out to the disability community. We work with the government of Manitoba, like they provide some of the funding, so that department there to what's called CLDS, or the Community Living Disability Services. They certainly are aware of us, and we've raised that awareness within their department. We've reached out to schools, to families. We have some really awesome family gatherings and kitchen talk, table talks that we do with families, just talking about resources that are there for people or how can we help build relationships. We have a real focus on relationship building, community development, and just really person-centered approaches. So I think we sort of reach out and have an awareness, or people are aware of us from different aspects and different walks of life. We really do try to do a lot of community development. So we have relationships with businesses. We have reached out to through our social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, things like that. Our annual general meetings are not usually that, I mean, they have the business piece to them, but they also are a real celebration of people and of relationships. So we invite community to come. We usually have a meal. We have different activities that happen that really build on people's learnings. We have like both a spring and fall events, and we try something different. Sometimes we have had, we call it a fall fling, where it's, you know, a lot of kind of social networking, and there might be a dance or music, things like that. We've also done a spring event that invited people to a spring market, and so people who with an intellectual disability who maybe do different types of crafts or have their own business, we offered space for them to use the market as a opportunity to share about themselves. So we just really are a part of life.
So in your time with the organization, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
I have been with the organization just over 12 years. It's been around for 25. So in my time, we have seen a real, and that's kind of the inception of Innovative Life Options, as well as Company of Friends, came when the Manitoba Developmental Center, which was an institution, started kind of its process of closing. And so people that lived in this institution were starting to move into the community. And so that was really wanting to see a different way of, like a different option for living, not in an institution, not in a group home, maybe not living with a family member, but just living in the community on your own. And so just that whole process and that whole movement has been huge. And we saw a very strong effort just recently in the last 3 years, and I think we're going to see a fully closure of that institution. So that's been huge, and we definitely have been a huge part of that in making that happen. I also think that just we have been part of a project that really looks at support networks and assisted decision making and what that can mean. So that project that started with just our kitchen table talks and family gatherings and has just bloomed into this bigger project, that definitely brings some happiness into my heart for sure. And actually each year, you know, I mentioned the annual general meeting. I have to say the last 12 years attending in the early June, our AGMs and just looking at the community that comes together has always been a huge part of my work, this work, the organization.
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
The push Patty mentioned towards deinstitutionalization, something I really do support firmly. For the fact of the matter is, for a person with a disability, they cannot be expected to understand or to live by society's expectations if they've never been a part of society. Sometimes we think, yeah, just shipping them off to these places might be the fastest and easiest solution. But you have to ask yourself, are they going to grow and develop and become the best possible version of themselves? The best possible citizen they can be if put into a place like that. Honestly, you hear a lot of horror stories concerning institutions. Sure, there are some that do some good quality work and really do support the individual. But to my mind, the best option is, was, and ever shall be that the person has that right to choose. Regardless of the disability, anyone has the right to explore their full potential as part of the community. Maybe it's a supported living situation. Maybe it's living entirely independently. The fact is, it's up to the person to explore whether or not they can do this. It's not up to us to simply say, we're going to ship them off to the side and say, that's the end of that story. Because honestly, it's passing the buck. It is not creating the best possible opportunities for these people. And historically, there have been all kinds of cases of institutions being responsible for abuse and mistreatment, what have you. That's why this push even exists towards shutting down places like that. The ones that do good work tend to be overshadowed by the stories of those that cause more harm than solve any problems. And honestly, that is a tragedy, because the initial intention has to be that they want to help these individuals with disabilities of any sort become the best possible version of themselves they can be, to be part of the community. The fact is, you think institution, you think of the old school myths and stereotypes toward that. And honestly, it's not something that should exist today. Looking back on that, historically, sure, there was a time and a place when medical science simply did not know how to care for individuals with more extreme disabilities. And their families, probably at that point in history, didn't know what to do either. But I have seen so much love and support from families over the years for individuals with disabilities. If there's a way to keep them as integrated into just day-to-day life as possible, chances are people are going to find it. And honestly, you can't just wash your hands of a situation because on the surface it's an uncomfortable place to look at. For a person with a disability can only grow and reach their best if they understand what it is to be a part of the community. They're allowed to explore all their life options. To have a job, relationship, friends, family, and education, all the little things we take for granted in life. And we cannot allow ourselves to slip back into any pattern that says, just because this is something I'm not immediately familiar with, I'm not going to look upon it. We have grown too much as a society. We pride ourselves on inclusivity, and we must keep that sort of momentum going. We must continue to recognize that people have value, that everyone can bring something unique to the table, an idea, a hope, a dream, a talent. The push towards including persons with disabilities must always be on our minds. No group should be excluded from being allowed to share what they have to offer this world. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.